Okay, so today on the podcast, we have Nick Fowler, and Nick is a producer from Hampton, New Brunswick, and currently he produces a lot of house, techno, electronic music, and stuff, and he loves cars, so I feel like he's an interesting guy. I've heard some stories about things he's done in his music career and cool stuff he does for his fans, so I wanted to get him on because I figured it would be interesting, and maybe there could be something of benefit that you could get from this. So welcome to the podcast, Nick.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, right on. So, man, like, how long have you been doing music for to begin with? I don't even know this.
Okay, it's time for me to give away something for free. First and foremost, I created something new called the Best Interest Games. Basically, it's for anybody with a growth mindset, whether you're just getting started on your journey or you are deep on the journey of Kaizen. Basically, every week there's a new 7-day challenge that's focused on helping you to become the best version of yourself, whether that's a cold shower challenge helping you to burn fat and build discipline, or a challenge getting you to get outside more, journal, meditate, make more money, improve your relationships, you name it. It is basically a self-development program with the incentive of challenges and prizes. So check out the link in the description if you would like to be a part of it. Second thing is, as some of you may know, I lost over 100 pounds and changed my life in 2017. Now I teach people how I did it. So if you want to book a free consultation, I'm also always doing free webinars, free coaching sessions. Keep an eye on my social media accounts. I have different program options. Some of them are covered by insurance. And at the very least, you can at least just digest my content. So thank you very much for listening and enjoy the show.
I would say, I played in bands and stuff in middle school, so I would say I've been kind of making music since middle school. Obviously not at the same capacity that I do these days, which, you know, it probably comes as no surprise. I wasn't a professional musician when I was 12. But yeah, basically I was writing music back then, and that continued all through high school, played in metal bands, played guitar, you know, that sort of stuff, which, carried me through to college, and I kind of started experimenting with electronic music. And man, college was I graduated college in 2008, so that was a long time ago. But yeah, I started off in middle school, I would say, playing rock music and Jimi Hendrix and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. I never would have thought that you were playing metal or rock music at all just from listening to the music that you do now.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of my heavier electronic stuff still has that metal influence. And if you look at the guitar that I play, it's a Strat HM, and HM stands for heavy metal. I've had that guitar since I think I was 13 or 12 or 13, something like that. But yeah, that was my background. And then kind of almost out of obligation, I found my way into the electronic music world because I was tired of relying on bandmates to make music, to practice, to, you know, back then my friends weren't as into music as I was. They weren't as dedicated to spending the hours, you know, because they had other interests, and that's totally fine. So my natural solution was to go to the computer and figure out how to make the other remaining sounds that I couldn't make myself.
That's awesome. What were you in college for to begin with? Was it for music or...
No, so I graduated high school in 2006, and then I went to NBCC for electrical engineering technology. So that's, I have a pretty good understanding of electronics, and, you know, we can get into that a bit as well. But that my background was electronics, and after college, I worked in the engineering kind of field for a few years until I could do music full time.
Okay, that's cool. Yeah, I heard you're making some pretty cool pedals, or you have made some pedals before?
Yeah, I haven't made any full-on pedals to the point where, you know, I like can package them and sell them. I just mostly for my own enjoyment, you know, I make weird effects and figure out interesting signal paths and stuff and use my electronic knowledge to just basically mess around and have fun. Maybe someday I'll offer some sort of product, but for now it's just mostly for me to get some satisfaction. It's kind of how I unwind. I design electronics and I design circuit boards and stuff like that. It's like my relaxing time.
Yeah, I saw you were building like a sort of Nintendo inspired pedal.
Yeah. So it's it kind of converts the signal to a square wave, and then because it's a square wave, you can feed it into like digital electronics and do some like logic kind of operations on it to divide frequencies and cut between two different signals at a fast rate. You can get all kinds of cool like chiptune effects out of it. So that's one thing. I've actually got that sitting on my desk just beside me here now.
Is it like complete yet, or you still got some tweaking to do?
Oh hell no! It's a it's a breadboard with about 1,000 wires running to a 20 different chips and stuff.
Oh.
It's far from complete, but it does sound interesting.
Yeah, I would have no idea where to begin with that stuff, but I think that's pretty cool. So when you were in those bands, did you like what did you take any of those bands seriously? Like, were you like, all right, this I want to like pursue a music career with this band, or did you only want to pursue music when you started exploring electronic music?
Well, the bands that I played in like high school, we didn't make electronic music. It was metal. We were really into Rage Against the Machine, Avenged Sevenfold, that sort of stuff back in the day. I would say we took it as seriously as anybody else in high school takes a band seriously. We had great dreams, but we obviously had no idea what we were doing. It wasn't until the electronic music really allowed me to get obsessed with sound design and production techniques and recording and all that shit in order to take it to the next step. And then I did also have a couple bands that were electronic music bands that combined the rock and the guitar and the drums and stuff, the live elements with the dance music and the electronic side of things. And we took those, we took those bands pretty seriously, and my company's name is called Technology Productions. It's like TEK Knowledge Productions, and that's kind of a nod to one of my bands, the Architects, like ARKATEKS. Tyler Lombard and I started that band in 2009, and we had pretty good success on the internet to the point where we were playing some showcases and kind of doing the whole ECMA, Music New Brunswick, Canadian Music Week, showcasing all that networking stuff. And it's really because of that that I've been able to meet the people that I've met, and that kind of springboarded me into a career of music production. So the bands in high school, that was kind of just my introduction to playing music with people. Then I got really into producing electronic music on my laptop by myself. Then that turned into, okay, I can't really sing very well or write by myself very well in terms of lyrics. So, okay, I met Tyler, we hit it off. So that turned into a band. Then, okay, we should probably play live. So that turned into a live show thing. And that was the progression. The high school bands didn't take it too awfully seriously. The bands after that took it very seriously, and now I take nothing seriously. So,
yeah. So that band, the Architects, was it a 4-piece band or just the two of you?
It was mostly the two of us. We also had my friend Ryan Eatman. He played drums with us live, and he also, he took part in some of the later stuff that we did in terms of writing and recording and production. But for the most part, it was Tyler and me. We were like the band. And then we had Ryan join us later on in the life of the band to mostly the stage presence of a drummer is kind of hard to replicate with a laptop and a drum machine. So that really helped us in the live music. It set us apart. We weren't just DJs in people's eyes. Now it was kind of like the best of both worlds. We were a quote unquote real band, but we were playing electronic dance music. So it kind of, and this was back kind of when EDM was a new term, like now everything is EDM. Your aunt probably knows what EDM means, but back then it was like, it's techno. Everything was techno. So it was kind of cool to have me play guitar, Tyler sing. I also played keys. We had, computer production stuff to bring the sonic, like the bottom end and stuff that you don't get with real instruments. And then we had our drummer, Ryan, playing along with us to kind of create this better experience for the audience than just us with a computer, which is how we started performing live. But we quickly found out that it just doesn't have the same presence on stage unless you have, like, a, you know, a drummer beating on some drums.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds pretty cool what you were doing. So what brought it to an end?
It just kind of got to the point, like, I think it was a learning experience for both of us. And I think the biggest thing that brought that to an end, and Tyler and I are still great friends. Like, we definitely, it didn't end on any sort of sour note or anything like that. We just kind of decided that it wasn't kind of going in the direction we wanted to. And I think for me, I can only speak for myself here, but I think we were too focused on writing music that was going to be popular, or writing music that we thought people wanted to hear. And that took, not only did that take a toll on us, you know, mentally, because we were kind of not necessarily loving what we were doing all the time. But also people's kind of bullshit detectors are highly tuned, especially these days. So with the amount of music out there, you can really hear if somebody is doing it for the right reasons, and you know, they're being creative and they're trying to express a thought or a feeling or themselves in some way, or if they're just kind of like hopping on a bandwagon, you know, oh, this is the next big thing. If I want to be a successful musician, I better start doing this thing, or I better start making this style of music. So for me, that didn't end the band. I think Tyler moved to Toronto. This was many years ago, so I can't really remember the order of operations, but Tyler ended up moving to Toronto. And I don't remember if that was like when we stopped making music as the band or not. It's a little fuzzy for me, but I know that the biggest learning experience from that band was that Tyler and I both were trying to be successful too hard. And instead of just trying to be creative and having fun and creating music that we want to make. So that was my biggest learning experience for that. And I think that's what ultimately led to us. We still work together and you know, chat, and we're still friends, but we stopped making music as the Architects. So
yeah. I think that's such a huge thing. What you said there is just making art based off what feels good to you versus what you feel other people want or want to hear or want to see. You know, that's such a huge thing. I feel like a lot of people fall victim to that trap, you know, because they want to.
Yeah, when you say it out loud, it seems kind of obvious, but it kind of manifests itself in different ways. It's a bit of a slippery slope too, because maybe you're like, well, you know, I'm still doing what I want to do, but like, it's not going to hurt if I do a cover for TikTok, if I do a cover of this song for TikTok, because that's going to maybe bring people to check out my original stuff. And, you know, so it's not just black or white, like you're either making stuff that you like, making real genuine art or not. There's a bit of a gradient there, but I think it comes down to balance, because ultimately you could be like Nine Inch Nails, do absolutely nothing but like authentic art at no expense, doesn't matter if it's going to succeed or not, and still succeed. That's like one end of the scale, and Nine Inch Nails is my favorite band. That's one of the reasons why they're my favorite band. Or you can go more kind of towards, like, I think, like, you know, Paris Hilton might have had like a bit of a music career at some point, and that's just pure like capitalizing off of some sort of strategic move to make money in some way, or, you know, it's strategy. So those are kind of, in my mind, the two ends of the spectrum, and everybody else kind of falls in there somewhere. You still have to be strategic, and you still have to, you know, be mindful of your branding and your marketing and stuff, but there's ways of doing that are more authentic than other ways. And that's kind of the challenging part, is making sure that you're not burning yourself out by just, like, you know, sucking the teat of the newest trend or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I love the collaboration camps you've been hosting, you know, bringing three musicians, songwriters together to, you know, just to maybe clarify for the listener, Nick hosts these collab sessions where he takes a producer, a writer, and a singer, puts them in a room for a day from 10 a.m. till 7 p.m., and your goal is to write and record a demo with the intention of actually using that demo to release it, you know, maybe pitch it to TV and film or something, or just do something with it. And I have found myself, I've attended three of those camps, or actually I've probably been there like five of those days. And I find like it's it really puts you into that creative flow where, you know, you're not really thinking about making music with like trying to copy anybody else or trying to do something or whatever. You're kind of just having fun with it. Like, to me, like every time I've been in there, it's just been like a blast. And, you know, every time I've done that with all the music I've created, I've always ended up creating the best music that way. Is just getting myself into that state of, I guess you could call it, receptivity, where, you know, those real authentic creative inspirations can flow through that are more unique and artistic versus kind of copy and pasted.
Yeah, that's the what I try to do with the camps is I try to take on the burden of you know, it's not hugely expensive for me to put on the camps, but just the burden of organizing, you know, getting people together, providing an opportunity and the context in which they have to like create and be creative. I try to take on all that stuff so that at the end of the day, if you spend the whole day and you don't even like the song you came out with, it was still a positive experience. And the only person that really has suffered from that is maybe the $100 I spent on food and stuff, you know, like, and the hours that I put into organizing and building the camps up. But what I try to do is I try to provide this opportunity for these amazing, talented people from around the area to get in and not worry about, like, you know, like they're not paying for studio time. So it's not like, oh man, we just sunk like $500 into, you know, recording this song. What if it doesn't make at least $500? Then it's a loss. It's like, at the very least, you had a fun time, probably shared a bunch of laughs and met some new people and built up some connections with other creative people around. So to me, that's the main reason I do it. You know, I've yet to make any money off of these camps, and that's okay with me. You know, I'm not doing it for profit. I have other ways to make money. I'm more so leveraging what I have to offer, which is the studio, the time and energy it takes to organize and connect people and build out these schedules and try to figure out all that stuff, the logistics and all that. I'm trying to offer that so that the people in the province can have this kind of chance to get together and have fun and be creative. So that's really the only goal, is to be creative. And then, hey, if we write a hit and makes a $3 trillion, then I'm happy to take a small cut of that for my efforts.
Yeah, exactly. I absolutely love that. And I've been having a blast there. And like I said, I think because of that environment that you've created, that at least for me, I love the songs that have come out of it. I think there's been like three or four that I've been a part of that, you know, turned out really well that we're actually going to use for something. So yeah, I appreciate that. And it really helps to like network with other producers and writers and singers, you know, in the Maritimes, which really helps out, you know, just creating more of like a community and just connecting more with fellow musicians.
Yeah, there's so many great talented people in the province, but I find we all kind of just do our own thing, right? Like, there's the live music scene is not necessarily the greatest thing ever out here. At least when I was playing live, it might be a little different these days, but
it's
you know, we're definitely not living in LA. We're definitely, yeah, you know, we don't live in a place where you can just walk down the street and there's creative people being creative, and you can just hop in and, you know all these people within a 2-minute drive, and you can. So I'm trying to give that sort of, because you know, I've done quite a few writers camps myself before I started hosting them. I never really thought I would host them because it just seemed like so much work. But I typically will go to Toronto or go to bigger cities to do these writers camps in these bigger studios. So I'm trying to offer my version of that to the people around here. And I think that one of the best things about it too is if you guys ever get asked to go to one of those songwriters camps, the bigger, more established ones with more established, you know, international writers and stuff like that, you won't have, it won't be your first time. You'll have the experience to draw on and you'll know what to expect and how to conduct yourself in these situations. So when I started doing writers camps, I went cold turkey into it. And I was like, I was so nervous. I didn't know what to expect. I thought, oh my God, what if I, especially being the producer, like, what if I don't like make anything good and we just like sit there the whole day and you have all these worries. And of course, once you're in the situation in the moment, it never really pans out that way. You're always amazed at what you can do. But at least this gives you guys, all the people that attend these camps, it gives them kind of that base experience that they can build on.
Absolutely, man. I really love that. And I hope to go to one of those camps someday. So what did... there was something I was going to say. It'll come back to me at some point. But... Mm-hmm. Whatever. I want to go back to, you know, when did FWR Fowler get created? Was it immediately after you kind of left that band, The Architects? Or?
No. So after The Architects, I started a band with my girlfriend at the time. Her name was Susan. She's a great writer, great singer. And we had a band called In Dreams. And we were more... We were more in like the synth wave kind of softer, more poppy, whereas The Architects were a bit more heavy and rock. In Dreams was more synthy, poppy, female vocals. We still had a drummer on stage because of what I learned from The Architects, you know, like the stage presence stuff. But that was my next kind of journey was with that band, and we released two albums with The Architects. We released two albums with In Dreams. You know, it's I have released more than two albums with Fowler, so I guess I've broken the curse, the two album curse. But yeah, that I started Fowler towards the end of my journey with In Dreams, and I started it because I had begun my music career in television, like the music for television, which is how I make my living. I started that, and I basically focused all of my energies, on producing for TV. You know, there was like a couple years in my life where I was still working a full-time job at Bell Alliant, in their engineering department there. And then I would come home and I was determined to be able to leave my day job and do music for TV full time. So I basically was like working two or three full time jobs if you include the music thing. But yeah, I would come home and spend all of my time and energy on writing for any opportunities I had in the TV world. And I had quite a few opportunities come to me through the CTV, through somebody I met there. And because I was focusing all of my energy on writing this kind of like production music, it was kind of draining creatively, because I was making mostly background music at that time. And the thing about background music is it can't be too interesting, because then it's not background music. You know, like it can't be too creative, because it's not background music. It's there to serve a purpose. And the purpose is to, you know, amplify whatever is happening on the screen or whatever sort of emotion you're trying to get across. And I'm not saying that background music isn't important. Like it's not that. It's just that it's almost a bit more formulaic than writing your own music and being creative in your own way, because you're kind of bending to somebody else's creative vision. So what I wanted Fowler to be was just a project where I could do whatever I want and not really care whether it made any money ever or not. I like, you know, whether any, even if I had a fan base or no fan base, I didn't really care. It was just really... it was just for me, which is why it's called Fowler, which is my last name without the vowels, you know, to be cool or whatever. But yeah, I started that because I kind of had this deficit of creativity of, you know, I want to make some weird glitchy music, but like that's not for background music, because it would be too distracting for background music. Background music has to have like a nice for the most part, for the background music I was making, it has to have, you know, a solid groove. It can't have any sort of like it can't be too jarring. It, you know, all these kind of rules that were implied so that it would fit with the visuals. I wanted to say, screw that. I just want to make my own weird music if I want to. So that's why I started that project.
That's awesome, man. It seems to have done pretty well for yourself. Do you still do the background music for TV and film, or is it just Fowler you're focused on now?
A lot of my energy is focused on Fowler, but I make my living still from CTV. I've written almost 700 songs for the CTV library, and I have numerous theme songs and stuff like that. That's what pays my bills. So that has kind of become my day job, you know, and Fowler has become my artistic kind of passion project, if you will. But honestly, My Fowler project's doing fairly well. I had a slow year last year because I was kind of focused on some other things, but it's done well for me, and it's really proved kind of the opposite of the architect's effect, where when you just do whatever the hell you want, people recognize that and appreciate that, so it actually becomes kind of successful, which is ironic because it's almost like the less you try to be successful, the more you are successful, at least in this situation. But yeah, the way I look at it now is my bread and butter is the CTV production library, and not only CTV, you know, like I have sync placements and stuff. Those are a little more, rare, I guess. CTV is a very good steady stream of work for me, because I'm able to create. I've done it for over a decade. Like I've worked with CTV for over a decade, so I can create CTV tracks really, really fast, and they pay quite well. So that's like my bread and butter. And then that allows me to be like, you know what? I want to put out this weird ass track as Fowler. I don't really care if it pays the bills. Like this is who I am. This is my brand, and I'm going to do whatever I want. So that's kind of that dynamic.
That's pretty awesome. I love what you built for yourself. You kind of have, you know, the two worlds going on where you're deliberately doing things to fit a box to make money, you know, because you have that position with them. And then at the same time, you have that Fowler where you're able to express yourself creatively. So when it comes to like writing songs for CTV, are you like watching the whatever it is, show or commercial or whatever it may be, and tailoring the music to it? Or do you just make like a bunch of like stock music that they can pick and choose from?
It's mostly what you would refer to as stock music. So the way we structure it is we make packages, and a package, you know, it could be 5 songs, could be 40 songs. I did a 40 song package one time. I'll never do that again. 10, 15 tracks is pretty reasonable. And the way that we structure it is it's almost like an album. So, you know, like there'll be a synth wave package or an aggressive EDM package or rocktronica package, like and it'll be a collection of tracks that all fit in that under that umbrella. And then what happens is I sell it to CTV, and then CTV uploads it to their library, and then all of the editors that work on shows like E-Talk and, you know, the TSN and the news and all that stuff, all the CTV Bell Media productions, they all they'll get notified, hey, we just uploaded this Rocktronica pack, you know, and I think they even have like artwork and stuff for it to try and encourage the editors to check it out and be like, oh man, this track has a sick riff, like this would be great for football or, you know, whatever the case be. So it's mostly writing tracks kind of en masse, like a lot of tracks, a lot of as the best quality and quantity that I can produce, so that these editors have the best and most plentiful choices of music to use in their shows. I sometimes I do write to visuals, but that's normally not through CTV unless there's like a specific, you know, like if I've done theme songs where there's opening animations and graphics and stuff, and I really enjoy doing that. That's really fun because you get to see the final product as opposed to just like, okay, cool, I wrote like, you know, 15 bangers, and then every once in a while you'll turn on the TV and be like, I think that's my song, you know, like that sounds like something I'd make, you know.
That's funny. So yeah, that's pretty cool, man. I love that the success you were able to create for yourself in that area of music. And I understand your Fowler project has had some success in placements and stuff. I remember you mentioned you were on, you had a song on Degrassi, and I know you've had some songs on Fortnite and Rocket League.
Yep.
And stuff like that.
Yeah. And recently, I think last year I had one on CSI, like whatever the new version of CSI is. And yeah, there's definitely, there's a place for the Fowler music in TV as well, which is great. And a lot of the times the music supervisors they're really out trying to find unique, interesting, creative music as opposed to more of just the formulaic stuff that there's so much of. So again, it comes down to almost like the less I try to create like successful music, the more interesting it is. And it might not apply to as many briefs, but the ones that it does apply to, it applies really hard, sort of thing. If you know what I mean, like it's a bit more niche, but the benefit of that is instead of writing a track that you could put under any car commercial or something like that, this track would only go underneath some like super high tech commercial for a car or something, just, you know, showing like an engine cross section or more specific. It wouldn't work with a bunch of briefs or a bunch of opportunities, but the one that it works for, it works extremely well. So it's kind of an interesting situation when it comes to that side of things. It's a little hard to explain without graphics, but I don't know if that makes sense. Like if you make kind of like more vanilla, if you make vanilla music that's a little more middle of the road, it will fit a lot of different visuals, but it won't fit them that well. And if you make something super unique and weird, it will work with barely any visuals, but the one that it does work with, it works extremely well.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it just goes down to standing out from the crowd. You know, if you make stuff that sounds like everything else, you're less likely to be noticed, even if it's done really well. And if you, you know, if you make something that's unique and stands out, then, you know, people are going to be more likely to notice.
Yes, exactly.
And that makes sense for placements too. I mean, because I guess, I don't know, if somebody's making a commercial, they're going to want, like, the whole intention of a commercial is to grab people's attention. So you're going to want something in the music that will grab people's attention, and if it's, you know, more unique, it's going to be more likely to, you know, grab their attention.
That's
like,
right.
Just like all those commercials we remember growing up as a kid, like they're still stuck into our head. And a lot of them are very weird.
Yeah, and a lot of those kind of commercials, they're cut to the music, so the music plays a much more kind of integral part of the entire package, as opposed to when you think of like a show like E-Talk. They're constantly cutting from shot to shot. The music's changing all the time. Sometimes the music's so low in the mix, you just kind of hear like the hi-hats grooving out. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's just that format of media, as opposed to a 15-second commercial that's trying to be really cool and memorable. Sometimes the music will take on a much more important role, where the tempo and the cuts and the different moments in the actual audio are almost driving the visuals more than the other way around.
But earlier, or should they maybe kind of just make that unique music and then pitch it? Like, what would you have to give them for advice?
I have probably a few different pieces of advice. I think like CTV, they're never going to want formulaic kind of copycat music, right? That's never the ask. In fact, a lot of the songs that get me the most royalties, because every quarter I get a royalty check. That's basically what my living is based on. And I can see exactly what shows use how much of each song and all that stuff. All that information is there. And the tracks that work best were the ones that I started with the intention of finishing for my Fowler project, or just like something that I started because I had this idea or I was inspired, and then it didn't end up going anywhere. And I thought, okay, well, I'm never going to finish this, so I might as well wrap it up into like a CTV track, like finish the structure out, and then I'll sell it to CTV. And then I think because the initial passion was there, the initial inspiration and creativeness was just, it's just kind of naturally baked into that. It's a better piece of music, you know? And then I can kind of tailor it if it's too, if there's, you know, vocals, chops or something that wouldn't work for background music or some weird, you know, sounds or something. I can massage it to be a bit more background friendly. So I wouldn't say you should ever really aim to write the library music. You should always just write a lot of music, because that's going to do two things. You're going to build up a huge library of even if they're just like a 30-second idea, sometimes 30 seconds is all you need for a commercial, you know? In fact, you know, how many commercials are more than 30 seconds? So write a lot of songs. Instead of, I see a lot of people spending so much time on one song that is never going to go anywhere, and they kind of lose track of the idea that this song, the value isn't in the song itself. The value is in the experience that you're getting by making the song. So it's almost like practicing, right? Like you got to practice a lot. So for a producer, practicing is producing, whether that's a finished song or just a beat that never goes anywhere. The people put too much, they invest too much of themselves into these ideas that aren't naturally flowing somewhere. So I think for a younger person that's thinking about going in this route, or an older person, whatever, somebody who's thinking about going down the route of TV and production music and that sort of thing, is make a lot of music and you know, build up a big catalog and get your production skills to the point where your workflow is fast, your turnaround time can be really fast, because all of a sudden, like you've seen me produce, like I'm just like on the keyboard and the mouse, I'm just like on fire, because I value workflow almost over anything else, because workflow is really the connection between you, your idea in your brain, and your idea coming out of the speakers. The biggest kind of hindrance to that is workflow. If your workflow sucks, then you can have the best idea in your head, but it's going to take you 3 hours to even just get it out. So write a lot of music that gets your workflow up and gets your catalog up. Cause sometimes I'll just like, you know, CTV is looking for a certain type of package, and the first thing I'll do is I'll just go through my projects folder and listen to a bunch of shit that I've made that will never go anywhere. And I can usually almost build an entire package just out of tracks that I've started in the past. So make a lot of music. That's one piece of advice. Value your relationships over absolutely everything else is another advice, piece of advice that I think I've learned kind of the hard way over the years. You know, you start to nickel and dime people, or you start to really think of people as like, what can you do for me? Like that's never going to work. Your relationships have to always come first. You have to make friendships, and then great things come from those relationships that you make. And when you're starting out, basically don't say no to anything, because unless it's going to put you in some sort of weird situation, say yes. Like take on every opportunity that you can, because maybe it doesn't pay you anything, but it pays you an experience. And yes, you have to start valuing your time at some point, but if you're just getting started, bending over backwards and helping people out and making their lives easier in terms of, like, you know, the people you're working with, that's always going to be the way to go, because this is a relationship centered industry. It doesn't really matter if you have a piece of paper that says that you went to college for music production. Nobody gives a shit about that. What they care about is how you are to work with, and if you're reliable and professional and trustworthy and all that stuff. So anyway, that was I just dumped a bunch of, I don't know if any of that was advice, but
I think that was great, man. Those are a lot of nuggets in there. I really enjoyed that. Thanks. I think that's going to help a lot of people. And so I know you have some of your, I don't know if it's all of them or, you know, a few of your songs signed to one of the biggest electronic labels, Monster Cat. That's pretty cool. Yeah. I know a lot of electronic producers like would love to be, to have their song signed by them. So.
Yeah, they're great. They're one of the few labels that has a really strong community built around the label and not necessarily around the artists. And that's really great for the artists because you just, there's constantly growing and churning community of Monster Cat fans. And as soon as you release on Monster Cat, you now have access to all these fans and they welcome you with open arms. And, you know, it's pretty crazy the difference that Monster Cat, releasing on Monster Cat makes for an artist. As long as you know, I've seen people release on Monster Cat and they didn't make the most of it, you know, like they didn't have the same experience as me, because for me, I enjoy earning my fans one at a time. So I have no problem hopping in, replying to all the comments, DM, you know, responding to DMs, sharing advice, listening to people's music, sharing my stems. Like I have no problem with spending the time and energy on those interactions, because I think that one super fan, like a fan that's more than just, oh, I know that one song that person wrote, you know, like somebody who's like invested in your project and your brand, that's worth probably like, you know, 1,000 normal fans that just listen to one of your songs and know who you are. So
yeah, absolutely. They say that, I forget the exact number, but it's something like, you know, if you have like 1,000 people who buy from your business or something, that can sustain you for a lifetime to like live off of, you know, if they're buying your merch or, you know, buying your cookies, if you sell cookies or whatever. So it's all about creating that like relationship with them, you know, rather than sort of just like using them.
Yeah. And that's the thing when it comes to Monster Cat, you know, like you have access to this massive community, and I don't take myself too seriously. I joke around, you know, like I'll record videos and take photos, weird photos of myself and joke around and all that stuff. It really converts these Monster Cat fans into Fowler fans. And I've seen people release on Monster Cat and they might, you know, they might reply to a few comments or hop in the Discord server for a little bit right after their release. But then they kind of neglect that community, and then that community neglects them back, because why would the community want to spend time and energy sharing their music with their friends and interacting, commenting on stuff, just engaging with you if you're not willing to do it back to them? That's something I think about a lot, is like, you know, it's exhausting, honestly, when you have even a moderate social media following, when there's a bunch, you know, you open your phone and you got a bunch of comments and stuff, which is obviously a great thing and is something that everybody wants. But you start to think, oh man, that it would be way too much work to like reply to all these comments. You know, like that's going to take me a long time to reply with more than 3 fire emojis, you know, like reply with an actual authentic message to that person. But I think, well, if I'm not willing to do it for them, why would they be willing to do it for me? You know, if I'm not willing to take the time to reply to them and to have a conversation with them, why would they be willing to do the same for me? So whenever I feel lazy, I that kind of comes to mind. And then I'm like, all right, looks like I have to spend this whole 36 seconds, you know, interacting with these people. Oh no. I think that's something that people take for granted a lot. They look at their social media as like a one-way street. They'll post stuff. And I'm guilty of this too. You know, like I'm not perfect. And I'm sure if you go digging, you'll find lots of comments that I didn't reply to. But I at least keep it in mind. And I try my best to make everybody feel heard and engage with them. Because that's what, I mean, we make music to have a conversation with people, right? And what's the point if you're the only one talking?
Yeah, exactly. I know a lot of people who, influencers and stuff, that treat their audience like a bunch of factory farm cows or something, just you know,
yeah,
just like constantly milking them for all they're worth and, you know, not really giving back much. So I think it's so important to genuinely connect as much as you can. You know, it's obviously at the end of the day, it really is impossible to, especially if somebody has a massive following, like you're not going to be able to reply to everything. But, you know, if your fans or followers see that, like, you are replying genuine comments to some people, they're going to understand that you just don't have time for everybody. And, you know, maybe at some point you will for them. And I think your approach to music and, you know, creating that sense of community with your fans and stuff, I think your success is a reflection of how you approach music, not including, you know, your sort of giving no shits and just doing whatever kind of music you want to create. So, yeah, man, I applaud you for that. I think that's great.
Yeah, it's definitely something that I've learned over the years, is that you have to enjoy the grind. You know, you have to enjoy that, the work that goes into building up a community of real fans who kind of become friends. You know, every week on Thursday nights, I have game night on my Discord server where a bunch of my fan base gets together and we play Jackbox games, we play other kind of party games, we play first person shooters together. And I think there's 1500 people in my Discord server, something like that. And I would say a large percentage of them I know to the point where, like, yeah, I'm actually, my Discord's always open on one of my monitors and I'm looking at the list of them, and like Eswin and Rayhem, they're my two moderators. I know them very well. They're actually kind of like some of my best friends at this point. Ashwin is a girl from Ireland, Scotland. Madalama is down in the States. Outer Knot is a graphic designer from the States. Singe, he won one of my Fowler Grand Prix races. Tim, also known as Jetpack, he's at almost every game night. Like, I can scroll down and I know at least like probably two or three things. I can picture there's a guy named Sebastian. His name is Susbastian on my server. He's from Mexico, and there's certain things that he says, like skill issue. He'll say skill issue when like somebody sucks at a game or something, like as a joke. And I can just picture his voice, like I can hear his voice in my head saying it with like a Spanish accent. So like you get to know the fans at like a granular level, and then when you hang out with them, and there could be some strategic reason to not do this because it kind of pulls back the veil on the whole mystery and all the whole rock star kind of thing where you kind of think these people are on a higher pedestal than you. When I'm like, if somebody's like, you know, hey, can you send me a video? One time somebody's like, can you send me a video of you apologizing? And I'm like, yep. And I like recorded like a 30-second video of me apologizing for like nothing specific, just like a generic apology video, like shit like that. Like I'll do anything. They're just like a bunch of my friends that hang out in one place, right? And then how that benefits me is, well, I have a new track coming out. They're invested. They want me to do well. They want the music to succeed. So they're gonna share it with their friends. They're gonna comment, they're gonna engage with it, they're gonna tell the algorithms that it's worth the you know, it's worth the algorithmic push and all that shit. So to me, I enjoy those the hours that I spend, because Thursday nights I spend usually about 3 hours playing games with them. Friday evenings, I do my production feedback live stream where I limit it to 20 songs because I already spend another 3 hours that night where 20 people can submit songs. And on stream, we listen to them. I give them good constructive criticism, technical feedback on the song structures. I offer my expertise and experience on it. So like all this stuff is a lot of work. It's 6 hours, but it's 6 hours a week. I don't know. Maybe that's not a lot of work now that I'm saying it out loud, but it's about 6 hours. It's about 6 hours a week that I directly dedicate myself to my fan base. And then the rest of the week, like I said, I have three monitors in the studio. I always have Discord up on my leftmost monitor. So like somebody could post something right now and I could just go over, you know, and I'm kind of bad for this, where like I might be having a conversation with you and somebody posts something and I'm just like, I just like reply to it or something while I'm talking. So I like multitask all the time. But anyway, all of that is to say, enjoy the hustle, enjoy earning your fans one at a time, and don't try to take shortcuts to success, because it never works. It's always the people that grind and put the work in and aren't afraid to spend the hours. Those are the people that do well, at least in my experience.
Absolutely, man. That's amazing. I love that you do that. And would you mind explaining the Fowler Grand Prix?
Grand Prix, yeah.
The Grand Prix, the Fowler Grand Prix.
No. Yeah. This is actually maybe the most work that I've done for arguably the smallest payoff in my favor. So for about a year and a half, and it all, honestly, it's one of the reasons why my output slowed down the past year, was because every song that I put out, I would have an ARG series of puzzles. They were usually themed around something. And what it was I would put out a song, and the first song was my song Freaky. That was the race number one, I believe. It's all on my website too. You can go and still do the races. People have won them all now, and they've all got the trophies and stuff, but you could still go and do the races, and you can also see how all the races were done. But anyway, what a race was in the song itself, there'll be a hidden code. I think every single song was in the spectrogram, actually. So you'd have to like look at the song on a spectrogram, which is like frequency versus time. And it would read out like a code. And then you would type that code into Bitly. So Bitly's like a link shortening tool. So say the code was like 339456B or something. You would go to bit.ly/that code. That would take you to a folder, and maybe the folder has like an image in it, and maybe in the image there's something hidden in the metadata, or there was something you had to zoom really far in, or you had to overlay another image on top of it. These are all things that I've done. And then that would give you a new code, which would take you to the next step. And some of these races had like, they had like 12 steps, and it like took, one of the races took like 3 weeks for somebody to actually crack it. The last one, actually, the one for the Lo-Fi Beats to Realize You're an Asshole too. For that song, that took like 3 weeks for them to crack it. Anyway, the first person to get to the end, there's like instructions on how to kind of indicate you're the winner. You had to comment a certain phrase on a certain post on Instagram and send me a screenshot, and then that person was the winner. They receive a trophy, which I made myself. So there's 10 trophies. The bases were made out of two and a half by two inch stainless steel. So it weighed like a pound and a half, just the base. And then there was like, I don't know, maybe a 6-inch post. And then there was a part off of my Eagle Talon, which is like always a big part of my brand for the Fowler Project. It's all centered, all my artwork and everything centered around that car. And these are parts that I actually used on my car, and I had taken off at some point. Maybe it was broken or I had to replace it with something. So all the trophies were made out of those plaques, and the plaques would have, they had like a gold, like a brass top with their names inscribed on it and stuff like that. And then there was a part off of my car on top. And then I also sent them a plaque with their names and a description of what the part was. Like it was like a, like there was a turbocharger turbine wheel and shaft. That was the last one. And it would describe what that part was and, you know, what I used it for or whatever. And then also there was some merch and stuff I'd pack up and I would ship it to them. And so in all, each song, I spent probably as much time or more designing these races as I did writing the song. And I probably spent about $150 per song, maybe even more. Well, with shipping, it's probably closer to $200 per winner per song. So to ship these trophies, you know, they're so heavy and it's a big package. And, you know, I've shipped them to Russia. I've shipped them to Scotland, like Ashley won one in Scotland. So, yeah, that was, oh, also they get entered into my pit crew group. So I have like a separate section on my Discord server just for pit crew members. And I get them into any shows that I do for free. So like I did a big festival down in the States called Grid Life, which was like a race car weekend at a racetrack, and Cascade was playing and Kavinsky and a bunch of big artists, and then a bunch of smaller artists like me. But anyway, I was able to get three of my pit crew members in for free to that whole festival with VIP things because they had put in the time to solve these problems and to solve these puzzles. And these puzzles are fucking hard. Like, I've put a lot of work into making them hard. This wasn't just something you hop on and, like, you had to be a super nerd to win these things. So anyway, that was the Fowler Grand Prix. I did 10 races. It's over. I'll probably do a season two at some point, but I'm probably going to hire somebody when it makes sense to do that to help me because, like I said, it really slowed down my song releases because now I didn't just have to write a song. I had to make a Fowler Grand Prix race for it too.
Yeah, man, that's just absolutely next level. It gets me brainstorming of ideas of how I could interact with, you know, my listeners for this podcast or my coaching platform and my multiple artist projects and stuff. So I think that's super cool, man. I think more people need to do like cool outside of the box stuff like that. I love it, man. That's great.
Yeah, I think it comes down to enjoying the grind because like I'm not even exaggerating when I'm saying I probably have 100 hours in MS Paint alone for just this, just a few of the races. Like I probably spent 100, I made a whole point and click adventure game. There was two episodes of it, like two races were dedicated to this. There was like, it like adds to the Fowler lore. Like there's all kinds of, it goes deep. And anyway, I probably have 100 hours just in Paint drawing frame by frame for this point and click adventure where you had to save the Talon from an atomic bomb. Anyway, it's this sort of shit. Like it's the grind and most people just aren't willing to spend the time to do that. But when you do, then all of a sudden your fans who are into that, they're like, man, he just spent how much time and how much money just so that like we could have this chance to win this part off of his car and you know, experience this. Like a lot of it is very humor based and stuff like that. So it really shows your fans that they're important and that you value them because you're willing to put in 100 hours into MS Paint just so that they can have fun and get a few laughs from clicking around a stupid point and click adventure game.
Man, that's next level. And I know you made a book too at some point.
Yeah, I have the Cursed Fowler art book again for the most extreme Fowler fans. So on my Discord server, I have One Word Story, which is a channel, and it's moderated by my bot called Carsbot, which is just the Talon. Anyway, if the basis of it is you type one word at a time and it creates a gigantic story. And if you try to type more than one word at a time, the bot will delete your message. So it's like policed. And we're almost at 40,000 words now. And it comes, you can imagine a bunch of people on the internet writing a big story one word at a time. You can imagine it gets pretty weird. So what I did was I downloaded, there's a command you can run that compiles it into a gigantic notepad. Like instead of having to scroll vertically to see one word at a time, it compiles it into a text document. And then my intern Atticus and I went through and handpicked like 20 of the best, weirdest, most out of pocket quotes we could. And then I have this other thing, another channel called Cursed Fowler, where I take really, really horrible photos of myself and I destroy them in like photo editing apps and stuff. It's just, it's part of my brand where I have a lot of really, really horrifying photos of my face. And I put those two things together. So each page has one Cursed Fowler image and then underneath it will be a largely unrelated quote from the one word story. And there's 20 pages and it's like a little, I think it's 6-inch by 6-inch art book I made maybe 50 or 100. I don't even remember. I sold like half of them and I only advertised it once. So if I want to sell more, I should probably advertise it more.
Yeah, really. That's great, man. Those are some all great ideas. And I'm definitely going to have to do something awesome at some point like that.
Yeah, it's the way to go. I mean, you got to create a fun experience. You got to create a brand and you got to make it enjoyable for your fans to engage with you. Like what the music is, I have fans that don't even like my music, so explain to me how that works, you know.
Yeah, really. Hey, that's kind of funny. That just goes to show it's all about like the connecting, creating that little community and stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, man, it makes me want to join that Discord server for sure.
Yeah, you should do that. If you have Discord, you should definitely hop on it.
You also like subtly inspired me to play Rocket League because I was like, "What is this Rocket?" Like I you just mentioned the song of Rocket League, and I was like, "What is Rocket League anyway?" Anyways, then my girlfriend actually plays Rocket League, so I started playing Rocket League with her. It's a pretty fun game, man. Car soccer.
Do you suck at it?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. She's pretty good, but like. I don't think anybody's as good as like the pros. I watched like a clip.
Oh, it's unreal.
Yeah, it was like next level, man.
And how good those people are.
I used to play like Halo competitively, so I can really appreciate pro gamers.
Yeah, it's nuts how they can fly around. I like sometimes we'll play Rocket League for game night on the server, and honestly, I'll just park on the side of the field. I'm like, the best thing I can do for my team right now is not get in the way because I'll probably score on my own net, you know?
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
Man, so what's with that gold record that you have in your studio that I saw?
Yeah. So one of the songs, I haven't really come out and publicly said this yet. But one of the songs, it's kind of widely known amongst the people who know me and my fans and stuff. Like I even have a DJ Khaled emoji on my Discord server.
I didn't know you could create those emojis.
You should see the emojis. Like the emojis on my server are insane. Anyway, and they're, most of them are like broken pictures of my face, which ties into that Cursed Fowler brand. But anyway, one of the songs that Tyler and I wrote with the Architects back in like 2009 or 10 or something, was sampled like Dr. Dre and LL Cool J, I think, produced the track for a DJ Khaled record. And the whole song is basically the intro from our song with a drum beat on it. And then Kendrick Lamar and a few other people were like rapping over it. So it's a song called Holy Key. And the song they sample is called Showstoppa by the Architects. And if you go, all they did was they took the intro, tuned it down, I believe down an octave or up an octave, or not an octave, a semitone. They either tuned it down a semitone or up a semitone and then put a drum beat on it and then got some rapping on it. And now it's a DJ Khaled track. And it took a while, like a lot of back and forth with lawyers, and it was kind of a mess, honestly. I don't really have a great taste in my mouth from the whole experience, but hey, I got a couple plaques out of it, so that's cool, I guess.
Yeah, really. How did you even find out about that, honestly?
One of our fans from the Architects messaged me. It was like, this sounds a lot like Showstopper, and then I listened to it, and I was like, this is Showstopper. So I checked it out, and... And then my lawyer, luckily I have an amazing lawyer in Toronto, Darlene Tonnelly. She's inter alia law. She did a lot of pro bono work for us on this because she really believed in our situation and believed in us. So she helped us out a lot. I have nothing but amazing things to say about that woman. And so we had some back and forth between DJ Khaled's lawyer and us. And anyway, it netted us some fancy plaques, and every time I look at it, I'm like, ha, that's funny, I guess.
Yeah, really. I guess you never would have known if you hadn't have created that fan base. Like, who would have told you?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, man, I find that whole thing pretty interesting, and to me it just sounds like a cosmic joke. But anyway, man, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate that. It seems to me the theme of the podcast was building a community around your art and maybe any business that someone might have, and just doing what feels fun and exciting to you and really not doing things just to fit inside of a box, because obviously that's proven to have success for you. You know, you have your day job at the end of the day, but you know, the one that's seen the most light is, you know, the Fowler Project. And I think it's pretty dope that, you know, you have your songs on video games and stuff. I hope to have my songs on video games someday. So it's awesome, man.
Yes, sir. Yeah, it's totally possible, dude. It's I think my main message to musicians in general, or even just anybody who has a brand, it could be music, it could be selling products, is be authentically yourself and don't take shortcuts to success because they don't work.
I love that, man. That's such a great tagline right there for this whole podcast.
Sweet.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, man, and looking forward to your next collab session. And if you're listening to this and you're in New Brunswick or, I guess, anywhere in the Maritimes, maybe check out Nick. You might be able to join the next one.
Yeah, reach out. All right, thanks for having me, man. It was great.
Yeah, thanks very much.